Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun, the podcast with your host, Tom Wilson, and guests from every corner of places that, you know, Tom's been and asked to be on a show. Brought to you by Tom's Art at BigPopFun.com. Moving pictures that make you happy. Hey, support the arts by buying art. Big Pop Fun, Tom, life, showbiz, people. Here's Tom.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks so much, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Big Pop Fun Podcast with Tom Wilson. It may surprise you to know it, but I am Tom Wilson speaking to this recording device right now from the Wilson World Studios in California, USA. Hey, people, let's go on a magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder. Why don't we? Refreshing our tired spirits over snow-covered peaks of life and fun and a new tomorrow? How would that be? All right, I'll lead you there. You know, as I talk about a lot on the podcast, I love visual art. I love looking at things. My dad always took us to art museums when I was young, and I love paintings, and I love photography. I studied photography. I did. I studied photography and film and developing and the chemicals and all sorts of things that have been now completely outmoded and made useless to me. So I might have studied blacksmithing. You know, that might have been more useful, actually, for me to study. And had I to do it over again, maybe blacksmithing or braiding leather into buggy whips. That might have been more useful than studying film and photography and those things, because now it's on your phone. But anyway, I love looking at things and noticing them and taking time with them and drinking them in. And I think everybody does too, because beautiful, as Dostoevsky said, beauty will save the world. This one's brought to you by looking carefully and pondering things. That was a little too deep, but whatever. You all know, Back to the Future was my first big movie, if you don't count being killed in the movie Ninja Turf. And I was immediately impressed and even intimidated, not so much, honestly, by Bob Zemeckis or Michael Fox or anybody. I was intimidated in a way by Ralph Nelson, a still photographer with a list of credits as a visual artist as long as two very long arms. If you took off one of my arms and put it at the end of the, yes, that. Ralph was really a brilliant photographer. And as I said before, like a noticer of things. You could see it in the composition of his photography. He sees pictures in his mind. And as painters and photographers know, most of the thing is seeing. Using your hands and running equipment is a tiny part of it. Most of it is being able to see the thing. And Ralph saw the things. You have seen his work in an incredible number of movies. I didn't even know when I first started doing movies, when you see those stills in a magazine, when you see that big big poster or that billboard on some, none of that comes from the film itself, the film that is shot by the camera. All of those, every shot, even if it looks like it's a scene from the movie, comes from the camera of the still photographer who is standing right next to the movie camera, and he or she is taking still photos of every scene that's going on in the movie in order to use them in magazines and all sorts of advertising and posters. And if you see a still image from a movie anywhere, a still photographer took that image, and chances are it was Ralph Nelson, whose dad we talk about, whose dad was a director, an Emmy-winning director himself. But Ralph's credits, I'm going to read a couple because you can't read them all. Go on IMDb, look up Ralph and everything. But, I mean, Mommy Dearest, well, for you sci-fi people, Star Wars, both Return of the Jedi and Revenge of the Sith. He did Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and War Games and the Karate Kid movies and Tucker with Francis Coppola and Basic Instinct and Batman Forever for the Batman people. But from the big movies, from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, he took his work from there to a movie like Snow Falling on Cedars or The Blind Side. So he's seen many things, been on many movie sets. And when I met Ralph, I'll tell you, I bothered him all the time. I joked with him. I asked Ralph a lot of questions about photography. And he always answered me patiently and tried to answer all of my questions in between little shots as he was trying to reload cameras with film. And I was, pretending like I was working on my lines. And then at the end of the conversation, Ralph would slip some kind of verbal whoopee cushion into the end of the conversation, and I would have to go off and do my work, and he would do his. He is the recipient, can I be all fancy on you, 2009, the Society of Camera Operators. He won their Lifetime Achievement Award. But he's an old buddy, and he's an artist of real gravity and experience. I hope you enjoy my conversation with my buddy Ralph Nelson.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Hey, Ralph. We've been friends a long time. And I go to your Facebook, and I just see a photograph of you. And it is a very rural photograph, like something Dorothea Lange would have shot in the 30s.
She did, as a matter of fact. That was her.
It was not.
Oh, okay. I lied. Go ahead.
But it's you, yeah, a number of African-American children.
Yes.
In a very rural setting.
Yes.
And there is a kid that looks like he's from Lillehammer, Norway.
Yeah.
In some beat-up duds and bare feet.
Yes.
So where did you grow up? Where were you born?
In Georgia. I was raised on a dairy farm in Georgia.
You really were?
I really was.
And dad was a dairy farmer?
No, my father was a playwright and a director in New York City. What happened was that during the war, World War II, he was assigned to come down to Georgia, and he was a flight instructor, which is where he met my mother, and they got married. I was the result of that, and I lived on my grandfather's dairy farm.
Oh, so granddad had a dairy farm in Georgia.
Yes.
He was a veterinarian.
Yeah.
But so you didn't grow up with dad there?
No, I spent my summers summers with dad in New York, later in California. But most of my childhood was spent on the farm.
So dad was a flight instructor, a playwright, and a director living in New York.
Yes.
And you were coming from your bare feet from Georgia to visit dad?
I rented shoes for the occasion.
Well, good. Was dad like the playwright in New York at that time? Was he a bon vivant, a city guy?
He was certainly a city guy, but I think that was very early in the career, so he wouldn't have been a bon vivant. But he did have a play on Broadway called The Wind is 90.
He had written?
Yeah, that he wrote. That Kirk Douglas was in it and a number of others. I think Douglas was the one name we'd all know still today. And His first love was the theater and writing. So that was what he was doing when he was when the war stopped everything and brought him down to Georgia.
So was he a flyer before that?
He
was
No.
So he just entered the war.
Right.
Ended up becoming a flight instructor.
Right.
Because it just seems interesting that you get into the war effort and they say, well, what are your skills? And he says, well, I'm a playwright. Well, we don't have a lot of use for that.
Unless you can write us an end of the war.
Now, he was Ralph as well.
Yes.
Right, Ralph
yes.
Nelson himself.
Right.
So Ralph said, we need flight instructors. You can't fly, but we would like you to teach people how.
But I play one on TV. Well, of course, they had to train a lot of flight instructors. There was mm-hmm. These guys all learned, many of them, at the beginning of the war, and then you went straight from, in his case, being a student to a pilot and then a flight instructor.
Wow. And then he went back to being a playwright after that. He didn't did he fly in his life?
No.
He was not an aviator or anything. He just kind of, that was a thing for the war.
That was it.
I'm a pilot. I instruct pilots, going back to being a playwright.
Yeah.
And what play did he write? Did he write a play that reflected his war experience or anything?
No, I think that The Wind Is 90, which was his play.
The Wind Is 90.
The Wind Is 90, which mm-hmm. means that's the direction the wind is coming from. It's an aviation term. And it was his way of trying to explain to his son then, the older son, my older brother, about the war. And it was the one thing that he hoped would explain it to my brother if he had died in the war, which was not going to be likely being a flight instructor. But in any case...
Had he perished in the war, mm-hmm. he wanted something where especially your older brother...
Yeah.
could read and know something of his experience in life and in the war?
I think in life in general.
Uh-huh. Did brother, what's your brother's name?
Ted.
Did Ted live down in Georgia with you?
No, he was a New Yorker. His mother, an actress, Celeste Holm.
I'll tell you, Ralph, you know the fascinating thing about doing a podcast like this is, now I specifically, like, I don't look things up, you know? I don't look people up, or I don't come with a list of I don't come with any 3x5 cards. I just think that you've lived a fascinating life. And then, you know, within the first 5 minutes of it, I'm already going, what? So your dad's first wife,
yes.
was a very famous actress, Celeste Holm.
Yes.
Lovely lady, celebrated lots of movies and
won an
theater.
Oscar.
Won an Oscar. Mm-hmm. What did she win an Oscar for?
Oh, don't ask me the hard
one. All right, sorry. Well, so you didn't look it up on the internet, too.
No.
So we're even. At least we're even. So Ted lived in New York.
Yes.
And he was significantly older than you?
I think so.
We'll be right back. I don't usually have commercials on the podcast, but I think we'll be right back after this message. Do you have internet access here? Yeah, Google search yourself and then maybe see how old your brother was. So not getting into family dynamics, but you weren't particularly close to that part of the family or your brother.
Of course I was.
You were. You don't know how old he was, but would he come down to Georgia and visit you?
Yes.
Oh, so he would come down, take his shoes off, and you would show him the cows and throw rocks with your brother.
We don't throw rocks. You throw cow pies.
You threw cow pies at each other, or you would look for distance and stuff?
At anyone.
You throw them at anybody?
Anybody.
But that was a very nice and formative time for you, I'm only assuming.
Absolutely. I love being raised in the country. I love being raised in the South. And it was a terrific time.
Uh-huh. Now, your mom, did she win an Oscar for anything?
I don't think so.
Okay. Look it up. Yeah. Look it up. But so you were there with your grandparents.
Grandfather.
With your grandfather.
Right.
And not mom or dad.
And my mother.
And your mom was there as well.
Yes.
Because it was her dad's place, her dad's house. So you did everything? I mean, you fed the chickens? You milked the cows? Did you do? You lived a farm existence?
I think I milked a cow once.
Really?
Yes.
What did they have back in olden times, Ralph? But they had, I'm sure, a big machinery on a farm like that of a certain size.
That was less than you would expect. They had just gone to milking machines. This is the early 50s. And so there was still a combination of machines in hand.
Really?
Yeah.
But you went to school down there and you went through high school?
Well, how long do you have?
Oh, I have a long time. Okay. I mean, I ask the stuff that I'm interested in. If you are uncomfortable with any of it, please, give me the high sign or just tell me and we don't have to. But, I find it interesting.
I went through the ninth, my first year in high school, I went to military school. I was fascinated by uniforms and it looked like a swell place to go, and my uncle had been there before. And so I decided, I want to go to military school.
So you asked to go to a military school.
And I was a terrible student, so they figured that's a good idea. That'll give me some discipline, something I was severely lacking in. Hasn't changed.
Just throwing cow pies and getting
throwing
in trouble?
Throwing cow pies, yeah. And so I went for my freshman year in high school and hated it, just hated it. And then when I came back to my sophomore year, I was in my hometown of Americus. Then the first half of my junior year, and I was doing so poorly then, I thought, you know, maybe I should go back to military school. Maybe I could give it another shot. And I did, and it was, I still hated it. So my senior year in high school, I came to California to live with my father.
Wow. Well, that's quite a quite a cultural whiplash.
Oh, boy.
Alone of military school, that's not for me. Yeah. Out of military school, well, I made a mistake. Military school, bang. California with dad.
Yeah. Oh, California was so different because there was a cultural diversity I'd never seen in the South. Keep in mind that when I was raised in Georgia, it was still segregated. And so to come to California when there were, you know, there were Asians and Hawaiians and blacks and Hispanics and God only knows what else, and they were all, I thought, this is wonderful. And it was, but initially it was a shock for me.
Where'd you go to high school out here?
Van Nuys.
Just Van Nuys High right there in the valley.
Now, here's the deal. My father lived in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. But you have an endless supply of jaw droppers here, Ralph.
Yes. His house, the pool was in Beverly Hills. The house turned out to be in L.A. County. So I would have to go, I think, to Uni High School. And the word was it wasn't great. So we used another friend's address. And every day I drove across the hill to Van Nuys.
From Beverly Hills.
From Beverly Hills to Van Nuys.
You drove over the hill. A lot of people won't know Los Angeles and how it works. Mm-hmm. But you traveled over a pretty significant hill and down the other side of the hill to go to Van Nuys High School, right smack dab in the middle of kind of Los Angeles suburbia.
Yes.
Because you thought that, because dad and you thought that would be a better for you, better education, less dead of that inner city.
Well, it was his decision based on the fact that Van Nuys had a much better reputation than the other school, which would have been my alternative.
Were you starting to shoot photographs back then?
Not until the last part of that year. In the last part of my senior year, I took up.
I'm interested. When you were, so you're a young guy and you're in Georgia and going to military school and everything, you know, not in any way junior psychologist, but were you, was dad this, were you trying to write plays? Were you thinking about a life in the arts at all?
No, I thought about two things, hunting and fishing.
So you're just an outdoorsman.
That was it.
You're just a Georgia, you're hunting and fishing, and that's it.
That was it.
And then senior year in high school, you begin thinking, you just got a camera and were taking pictures at school?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And puberty has something to do with it as well. You know, it tends to change one's focus.
Sure. You needed something to talk to girls about?
Yeah.
Like, dude, check out my brownie. What was the first camera you got?
I borrowed my father's Rolleiflex. As a matter of fact, my first camera, it was here for me a little while ago, was a Brownie Hawkeye, and I still have it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you take photos at school or just personal things?
Mostly personal things. The thing that got me interested was the old Walt Disney nature series.
Mm-hmm.
And I love those because they were great. There were stories about the deserts and the rivers and the forests. And I would go and watch those on Saturday and think, you know, I could live in the woods and take pictures of animals. What a perfect life that might be. That's where I got started.
So even in high school, you were thinking,
oh, yeah,
that would be a nice way to make a living.
Yeah.
To just be in the woods and get to fish and hunt and sometimes just shoot photos of them.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Now, did you go to school after high school or did you just shoot start
then? I did. I had applied to Art Center and was turned down and then went back to Georgia and worked for a year, reapplied, and that was accepted.
In photography?
As a photo major at Art Center. It was in the Art Center School on 3rd Street.
Mm-hmm.
It later became the Art Center College of Design, and then moved to Pasadena and built that great campus
right
there now.
So you went off just to make some money?
Yeah.
In Georgia, working the farm, or?
Well, I also worked on one of my father's films.
What did you work on?
A thing called Duel at Diablo.
Duel at Diablo.
As an actor, yeah.
Wow.
Now, see, I never intended or even care about being an actor because I didn't want the attention. But it's a great way to make money, and it was fun.
Who was in Duel at Diablo?
Sidney Poitier.
Was he?
James Garner. Dennis Weaver. B.B. Anderson.
And Dad wrote it and directed? He was just a director at that point. Because your dad, the only thing I know about your dad is he directed really one of my favorite movies, The Lilies in the Field.
Yeah.
Which, a movie that I just love that many people, many listeners to this, certainly haven't seen. Just a very simple black and white movie with Sidney Poitier in it, about a guy who just comes to a very rural area and just helps some nuns build a church and then goes off. And I saw that when I was a little kid, and Sidney Poitier plays what? Homer Smith. Schmidt, as the German nun calls him. And he ends up living there for a while out in the back of a station wagon. And I don't know why, Ralph. I was a little kid in Philadelphia, and I'm watching this movie, and I'm thinking, boy, wouldn't that be great just to live in the back of a station wagon? You know? I think I'm going to do that. I'm just going to live in the back of a station wagon and go around and helping people. I didn't know that you needed money to live or whatever, or why he was living in the back of a station wagon. It just seemed like, boy, that'd be fun. Just kind of travel around, come out of your station wagon.
Sing some gospel songs.
Sing some gospel songs and then move on when you're done. But people, I'm sure people don't know, or young people certainly don't know where that scene, Amen, came in. And that song, Amen, Amen, that whole thing, Sidney Poitier. I sit up, we sit up, we sit down, we all sit down, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was Sidney Poitier close to your dad, or did he like working with him or something?
Yes, they did several films together. And don't ask me the titles, because...
No, I won't, because clearly you don't know. No, yeah, clearly you're upset about the question about Ted, so,
Who's Ted?
See?
Okay.
But, so you actually worked as an actor. Was that in high school?
Well, that was after high school. But I'd also done it as a young boy. And when I went to New York to visit him, I was in a couple of TV shows then.
Like live TV?
Yeah.
Do you know any of those titles?
Yeah.
Whoa, come on.
There was a series that he directed for a number of years called I Remember Mama.
Uh-huh.
And I was in that a couple of times. And then another one called Windows that I was in. And...
But it didn't give you like what they call the bug at all.
No,
you just were there at Dad's work,
right?
And you were just being asked to do some stuff. So you said, "Well, I figure I'll just do it."
I never cared about the attention. No,
in fact, you didn't like it. It seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indifferent to it.
Right. So we're back at Art Center, and you're studying photography.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to do wildlife photography.
I wanted to do photography. It was becoming more of a general area at that point, because it was initially the love of nature was what brought me to it. And then when I saw the other things that could be done in portraiture and editorial work, and that then began to expand more.
Mm-hmm. It's really, it's interesting that exposed to so much of the arts in plays, in live television, in movies, Dad's writing, directing, but you picked such a visual and still medium, you know, that you just, nothing moves, nothing, I don't have to write it, I just have to see something and then share that thing that I see with people. I mean, did you connect with that, or did it seem just like be a decent job?
Yeah, what you just said.
But... You know, with the other thing that I said, the thing before was a good thing.
That
you don't have to write anything or ask actors to do things. You're just saying, I saw this thing and it just struck me and I wanted to show it to you.
Well, I really have a hard time giving it the explanation that it needs, because I love it so much.
Yeah.
And because it, for me, is a way of connecting with everything around me. And especially at those times when I'm doing work for myself, is connecting with that which is greater, you know, than the self. And that's when it's most important.
Connecting with something greater than the self.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Is it something that is that rises everyone, rises you as the artist and the viewer above the simple plane of, you know, our human troubles and whatever of the day?
Okay.
No, that wasn't bad. I did the previous one. I did better than that last one. but I don't, you know, I'm not editing this, so now I sound bad.
No, no, you don't.
So no, the next one I'm going to come right down the middle and not be particularly brilliant or stupid. It'll just be, all right, that was all right. So did you start just working as a photographer then?
I did. My very first assignment out of school was for Playboy magazine. I submitted a girl.
Well, tough gig as a young guy.
Yeah, right. It was a mistake on their part, I think. I had submitted a girl as a possible playmate, and they rejected her, but they said that we'd like your work and we'd like to, you know, like to go shoot this for us. And I did, and I got a number of assignments like that. I did one that...
How did she take it? Go ahead, listen, Gina. You know that thing? That's not really happening, but I have to go back there because they hired me.
Well, they hired me to go. They had a series at the time called The Girls Of. There was like The Girls of the Riviera and The Girls of you name any geographic area, and they would do that. So they sent me down to the Caribbean, and they said, what'd you do? The Girls of the Caribbean. It was... Go down, find girls, take pictures, and come back. And, of course, I was 21, and...
So you were sort of your own talent coordinator?
Everything.
They just, take your camera, yeah. Go down there, and come back.
Right. So I went down and spent, I think, a couple of months traveling from one island to the next. And then when I came back, there wasn't sufficient material to do an article. So they said the next year, listen, go back again. And let's try this again. So I went back the second time, and we still never got enough material because there were not many girls who would either do it or fit the bill for Playboy material. The first time they said, okay, you can only shoot people who live there. And the second time they said, shoot anybody you want, you know, anybody you see. But it didn't. It never worked out. It never ran. So somewhere in the archives, there's the unpublished Girls of the Caribbean.
Wow. And what'd you do? How did the whole movie thing start? I mean, I would love, because I'm interested in what step was that, but I don't want to take too much of your time. And what did you do after that and after that?
Okay, well,
I'm certainly interested. Yeah. Like what the steps that a photographer takes in order to get to clearly, you know, the top of the heap.
Right. Well, I had been working, doing freelance work for magazines for the most part, and then ABC decided they needed a staff photographer. The other two networks, and there were only three at the time, ABC, NBC, CBS. ABC didn't have a photo department or a photographer. And so they sent out a questionnaire, and they looked for a photographer, and they tested a number of people. And I was recommended, as a matter of fact, by Playboy. And so they said, would you come by and talk to us? I did. We all shot the same person as a test. They liked my work, and so they hired me. And I was there for just under 2 years when I got a chance to work on my father's film, another film of his, that would allow me to get my union card.
Ah.
At ABC, I was staff, and so I couldn't work any union Joes. At that time, the only way to get into the union was to have someone die, and you're standing behind him in a line. So by working on that film, I got exactly the time I needed, 30 days of work in.
And what film was that Dad was doing?
Give me a minute.
Okay.
Sounds like first syllable. Rock Hudson.
That's all right. But he was working on something or other.
Yeah.
And Rock Hudson's in it. He knows you're an ABC staff photographer. You've done magazine spreads, editorial work, all kinds of things. So he is not. It is not. Hey, my boy here can. You know, he's got his brownie, Hawkeye. Come on out, Ralph. I mean, you were a professional photographer of very significant note. When Dad said, or you said, hey, I could use this in order to get into the union.
Right. I was established at that point.
Yeah.
And so I did that. And the film, by the way, was Embryo. And so I did that. And then the union, once I was in, was not allowed to work for several years because they had a seniority system. You couldn't work unless all the top guys were working.
So really, you get into the union.
And then you can't
work. And they just announce, Ralph, congratulations. You're in the union. Now go sit down on the bench. Because all of these other union photographers will get the job before you.
Yes.
So what do you have to go out and get those other kinds of jobs in order to just pay the bills.
Back at freelancing.
Back at freelancing until something happens. Until a guy
died, literally
at times.
Yeah. And then when I got back into doing films again, that is when I was allowed to work. Then the work came on a regular basis.
In movies.
In movies, yes.
After a while of that freelance.
Right.
And what kind of movies were being done then? What did you find yourself shooting?
You know, there have been so many. It's really hard to look back.
But no genre kind of thing was happening.
No, there were.
Just every kind of
anything.
Thing.
Because I had had very good luck early on and did some good films and got a good reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I stayed fairly busy for a while.
And this was a time when it's almost unheard of now, but you would be on the set. That guy that we see in many photographs of photographers of that era,
yeah.
With many very heavy metal camera bodies all slung around your neck,
yes.
Lenses everywhere, and these two bodies are shooting black and white film, and these two bodies are shooting color film,
right.
and so you were very, very busy loading, unloading film. And were you developing at the time?
No, that was a different union.
You couldn't get in the developers union. Wow.
No.
Fortunately, around those chemicals, though, the developers die more quickly. So it's, you know, you're able to rise up more quickly.
That explains why they haven't been calling lately, doesn't it?
Exactly. Well, a lot of film places haven't been calling very much at all.
Yeah.
There's one guy left with a lot of rolls of film going, what happened?
Yeah.
So you were shooting all kinds of different movies.
Yeah.
With all kinds of different, well, cameras. Did that begin in the very beginning of photography? Was it still a chase for technology like you see now? Were you buying, I bought these four bodies and you shoot them for 8 months or a year and then some guy tells you, oh, you got to get these, Ralph.
No.
Those are outmoded. Forget it.
Not like it is now. As a matter of fact, if your audience will look to my left, you're
yes.
Right. Those two Leicas there.
You've got Leica rangefinder cameras. Now, people into photography will understand what they are, and many people will not. But they are among the most storied and famous and excellent pieces of equipment
yes.
In photographic history.
I had carried those two. They're sequential serial numbers. I bought them in the mid-60s. I carried them until the end of film. That's 40-plus years with those two bodies.
And working perfectly.
Yes.
And for our audience, I can say they're very expensive cameras.
Yes, they were very expensive.
Yes.
They were all of, I think when I bought them at the time, and this may sound silly, but they were $264.
Mm-hmm.
Now, digital cameras, a typical digital camera, or not typical, I bought two digital bodies for $8,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
A year later, they were worth a third that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that racer technology didn't happen really until digital because it was changing every day at lunch. And new cameras came out, new technology improvements.
With the pixel numbers speed of lenses, how much light is coming into a lens for the camera to be able to pick that up.
Lenses changed less,
mm-hmm.
but the bodies were changing significantly.
And at the end of our Leica discussion, we should add that literally these two magnificent German-made machines of photographic history are being used in your office here. As bookends.
Yes. they are screwed to plastic mounts. They are now bookends.
They are
left
bookends.
And right.
Just magnificent Leica rangefinders as bookends. It's, it's quite something. The time marches on. And what are you shooting with now?
An iPhone.
An iPhone.
And you think I'm joking?
I don't necessarily think you're joking. Is that all of the... we're skipping a lot of things, but...
Yeah, well, there's a big chunk in the middle that's missing.
Yes.
No, for years I've been using Canon,
mm-hmm.
and I have now retired from the film business. So I'm not buying cameras as I once mm-hmm. was. I have last year's models, which are more than I'll ever need. But right now my favorite camera is my iPhone. I've done an entire book of flowers or flower photos just using that alone.
From your iPhone.
Yeah.
And you find the lens sharp and fast.
I do.
It's spectacular, really. I mean, it's sad that these Leica rangefinders are bookends,
mm-hmm.
but it's also liberating for you and maybe for the world that you can take photographs that you find absolutely sharp and excellent, and it makes the statement about your photography that you want to make with a phone.
Yeah. And the beauty of it is that there are no controls. You simply point and shoot. And so it forces you, as it did when I had a Kodak, you know, a little Kodak Brownie, that your one, the one thing you have control over is the framing of the picture. And all of the other issues of the technological issues of lenses and f-stops and shutter speeds, it's all gone. And so it limits you, but at the same time it liberates you from having to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And you focus entirely on the subject.
When you do you ever take portraiture or figures with your iPhone?
As a matter of fact, I worked with Russell Brown of Adobe doing a thing recently at the Annenberg at one of his lectures. We're doing a similar one next month up at, in Monterey at the EG conference.
Now, what does Russell Brown do at Adobe, or what does he...
The creative director at Adobe.
Uh-huh.
And so I'll be going with him to the conference and using the iPhone for portraits.
Now, what do you do? Is there a setting in order to replicate the I'm getting all photography laden now and maybe mm-hmm. boring people, but I what I'm interested in is in portraiture in a film camera, you would have a certain aperture in order to keep the person's face or head very focused and take everything out of focus to open up the lens wide. Now, do you do that in Photoshop, or what happens?
Far less. As I said, you don't have those controls at all anymore. So then you are limited to using the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the only control you have is where you put the light. The rest you can do later in Photoshop, if necessary. Quite often, it's exactly what you need without anything else.
So you've spent this life on sets with these, holding these big, they call them blimps for those people who don't know. It's a giant, I didn't know what it was the first time I was ever on a set. And a guy comes up with really a giant black square of maybe 1 foot by 1 foot mm-hmm. with a big, big looking lens or almost a gun turret coming out of its front. And of course, I think I like photography. I know a little tiny bit about cameras, but that's the most unusual thing I've ever seen. And I didn't know what it was. And what it is, as you certainly know, Ralph, but maybe our audience doesn't, is that it's called a blimp. It is a soundproof box that you would place your camera body in,
right,
in order to not make noise,
yes,
when actors are acting. Because that's the ultimate crime, isn't it? When actors are when a temperamental actor is doing something and it's just the wrong moment and you go ka-chick.
It's not just the actor. You can ruin a soundtrack, and it can be very distracting as well. So it's an essential piece of equipment.
How did you begin working with actors in that way? Since you had been around them,
yeah,
and you knew the actors working with your dad, and you'd been on sets and you'd been on TV sets and everything, what was your relationship with the actors when you started to be, you know, a working person on the set?
I don't know that it changed anything, because I don't think I treat them any differently than anyone else. Certainly in what I do, it can be very distracting. So you have to approach them with some caution and respect. And sometimes it means not shooting. You know, sometimes there are some actors who are very difficult, because if you are within the same county, they're aware of it. There's a disturbance in the force for them, and they can be very difficult. But those are very few, though.
They're, yeah, most. And I don't do the gossipy I want names thing on this podcast.
Oh, darn.
But my hey, if you'd like. But my thing is, do you think... I guess my question is, when those guys or girls mm-hmm. are temperamental and demonstrative, do you find that they're actually searching for something as an artist, or do you think that most of it is just kind of self-aggrandizing phoniness, that they just, you know, somebody just wanted to go off on a day, and it was the chicken was improperly prepared at lunch, mm-hmm. and so they're just going to fry up a bunch of people because they can?
There's only one of those.
Oh, there's okay, I want that name. Really? Over so many years?
No. Look, I can't tell you what their reasoning was, but you simply have to still give them full respect because it's what they're doing, whether their motivation is right or wrong, and what they're doing is still very important.
Yeah.
And so you have to respect that and find a way to work with it.
I was the only guy, and I'm not there's no pedestal, but I've just been on a lot of sets. And the guy who's the – did you do the Batman movies?
One of them.
You did one of them. Yeah. Which one did you do?
There's that question again.
What was the guy? Who was Batman?
Val Kilmer.
Oh, okay. So nobody saw that. So it doesn't matter.
Neither did I.
No. Nobody did. Don't feel bad.
Batman Returns. Okay.
Nobody cares. Okay. But the one I'm blowing it now because I can't even think of the actor's name. The guy who was the most recent Batman, where it was publicized, one of his tirades, where he really lost it mm-hmm. on the set. And whomever, the sound recorder or the producer or whomever was around, made sure that the meltdown mm-hmm. was recorded to be released on YouTube and on sites to say, see, he's crazy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the background of it was or what had happened, but it was the talk of everywhere in Hollywood. Did you hear that, meltdown of biblical proportions? I think I was the only guy not totally defending him, but saying I don't think anybody understands the pressure that guy is under. And how many people are coming up to him and asking him a thing when he's trying to concentrate or he has a big speech or he has to swing on a rope above a car that's going by and he has to, do something or something like that. And everyone else, and I'm not finding fault because there are all sorts of craftspeople on the set. Yeah. But as you know, Ralph, before that shot or whatever's happening on that day, mm-hmm. everyone has to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And the bootmaker is adjusting your boot, and the wig maker is adjusting your hair, and the cape person is on your cape, and this person's asking you, well, tomorrow when we have that scene, and everything. So it can lead one to get a little wiggly.
So was this video about you? Is that what you're saying?
No. It wasn't me at all. It was everyone will know who I'm talking about, and I just can't think of it.
Wait, here's the one guy. You're talking to the one guy who hasn't seen it and really doesn't care. And you know what? I think your defense is probably rational and smart because it is a difficult process. And even, you could parse it and say, look, the guy's being paid a fortune. Well, that does. The fact is, he's been besieged all day long by these people you're talking about. The photographer is the last one to be in there with him. And the one in his island, he's the person who's there during the scene. And so I can see that happening.
Yes, because you are – because the camera's there and the camera team is there, and you, Ralph, are literally standing right next to the camera, right next to the lens with your own lens, shooting your still photographs mm-hmm. that will be used in advertising and on posters and every kind of thing. So it's a really it's an interesting relationship, I think, between actors and a person like you. And when we first met – I found you, like so many people, you just had a humorous yet completely unobtrusive manner. But I mean, it was artfully done and you know me. You certainly know me now after decades. I'm just your basic goof off and, we could joke about anything.
Right.
But you're approaching every one of the actors and the director in a specific relationship, realizing that when push comes to shove, you may need to just vaporize.
Yes.
And just vanish.
And you can't take it personally. And mm-hmm. it should not
mm-hmm.
as a photographer. And so if there are people who are considering doing this for a living and maybe one is listening, I'd say don't take it personally. It's business. And those explosions and those disagreements and those tense times can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, they are, you can explain them away, as you just did. It is less often than I think it's an ego issue.
Yeah. Oh, and I'm not excusing treating people badly at all.
Right.
It is wrong, you know, in any capacity, anywhere, to lose your cool and yell at people.
Right.
You know, but I think I just try to put it in perspective that, as you know, and you know, you joked about, but there are definitely jerky people who just want to ride people and just want to give them a bad time. I've certainly worked with them. You've worked with them. And sometimes you're just catching a person under a lot of pressure on a very difficult day, and they're just getting pushed by people. I mean, I've seen, you know, whatever. It's the actress who wants the director to give her close-up for this scene. And we're in a gigantic convention hall, and we've got 200 extras and that thing. And you can see the director beginning to bubble. And she's in the, you know, she's in the retinue, sort of following him around.
Right.
Just going, Rick, are we going to be able to do? And you're thinking, don't do it right now, dear. Don't do it. The time bomb is ticking. He's beginning to flash. You know, he's going to pass out in a minute. And then, of course, she just asks one too many times. I really think the camera should, well, do you want to pay for it? Do you want to pay for the shot? Because I'm in and up to here, and I've got 200 extras, and I've got to get out of this shot. So if you want to pay for it, go tell the producer that I'm picking up the bill for the rest of the movie. If you don't want to do that, go sit down, and we'll shoot this in a mass. Leave me alone. And then the actress swallows her tongue and goes and sits down.
I wish I knew that speech when I was working. It would have served me well for about a minute until I kicked off the set. But, you know, it also brings to mind, though, that people will often ask me, who's the most difficult actor you've worked with? I'm very rarely asked, who's the best?
Right.
People will often say, well, who's the worst? Who do you not like? So,
well, that's the gossip thing, isn't it? That's just Entertainment Tonight. It's just Hollywood. And we love just digging the dirt on the bad people. No. But who is the best that you've ever worked with?
Other than you?
Come on. Okay. You're just saying that.
Yes, I am.
Oh, man, not even one. Not even once. No, Tom, no, seriously. Not even once. How have you really enjoyed working with? Where have you had not only a good personal relationship, but you think that they helped you and you worked well together?
A recent one, and recent in my career, was because I would be, I was trying to say Stan Laurel.
Stan Laurel's dynamite, Ralph. Boy, when that steering wheel came off the car and it went crazy and they hit that telephone pole.
It's a strange thing. As I saw his face, the name Stan Laurel came to mind. It has nothing to do with Stan Laurel. I don't know who I was talking about or who I'm talking about now.
Okay, who's just an ace in your book?
There are a number of them. But I have to come back to that because offhand, now my mind went blank. My alleged mind has gone completely blank. But
well, you think of that.
I'll tell you what. I can tell the women right away.
Okay.
Dolly Parton, Sandra Bullock. Both just great ladies.
Just great ladies?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And both quite professional.
Oh, absolutely.
And both smart as a whip.
Yes.
I mean, both doing their business, understanding their character that they're playing, not only in terms of an actress, but the who they are and the business that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're smart cookies.
Yeah.
Boy, I've got to let you go pretty soon. You've talked a long time.
Oh, no, I've got all day now.
Oh, good. Okay. Can we talk about your aviation?
Sure.
Your flying?
Yeah.
Because I didn't know that about your dad, and I think that that's an interesting thing, that dad was an aviator for a brief period of time, ended up actually training pilots for this brief window in his life, let it go, went back to writing plays, and yet somehow, Ralph, was that a seed in you becoming an aviator? I mean, you have planes, you love flying.
No.
Not at all.
What happened was that I was in a commercial plane crash.
You were in a plane crash?
Yeah, in a commercial plane crash, in a commuter crash. We crashed off Catalina Island.
How many people are in the like a big plane?
Yeah, it was a twin engine. It was a Grumman Goose, which is an amphibious plane. And we took off from Long Beach, and I was in the co-pilot seat because the back was already full, so there's no room left. So they put me in the co-pilot seat.
How old were you?
17. And we flew to Catalina, and my father was in the very back. And as we took off, he said to my younger brother, who was back there with him, he said, well, if you look at the shadow, you'll see the wheels come up. And he didn't. But then, of course, as you get a few hundred feet up, you don't see that. The shadow's indistinct. So he thought no more about it. We flew in and started to land in Avalon Harbor.
Into the water.
Into the water. The gear was down. So when we hit the water, it's like hitting a brick wall.
So the pilot just had never retracted the landing gear.
He did not retract his gear. Hit the water. The nose instantly went straight down. The pilot and I were underwater instantly. And my seatbelt held me in, so I was thrown down into my lap. When that happened, my window came up and cut my seat and just sheared it in half.
So you leaned down with the impact.
I was thrown down, yeah.
You were thrown down, right. But the window of the plane just cut the seat behind you.
No, cut my seat.
Oh.
In half. So the plane was, at that point, inverted, and I've been knocked out just very briefly because I remember thinking, this is very strange. And like a movie, it went in slow motion. And then I breathed in and choked on the water and instinctively undid my buckle and swam forward and came up to the surface. The plane was upside down, and I was the only one outside because I'd gone through the front there.
You went out through the windshield.
Right, through the windshield in the front. And I crawled up on the wing and opened the door, and all the passengers were hanging from the seatbelts because the plane was inverted. So they're all dropping to the ceiling, which is now upside down. It's filling with water from the cockpit. My father was convinced that I was dead because he'd seen the front being torn away. So it made no sense to him when I opened the door and it was staring him in the face, and he's in the back of the plane, and I hadn't come back through the plane again. I was outside. In any case, everyone got out okay. The pilot had gone through the windshield. He wasn't even wearing a seatbelt. And so we all got out. I helped carry him to shore.
You guys are, like, everyone's swimming.
Yeah, we all swam, and it was December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day of 1963. So, and it was freezing cold and trying to swim through kelp.
Well, the ocean is so cold here. Yeah. The ocean's cold in California in the summertime, mm-hmm. but in December, that is very cold water. Yeah.
And so, in any case, we all got to shore safely. I'd cut both wrists going through the windshield and had some facial cuts. In any case, I got... Let me back up a little bit. Back then, litigation was not the way it is today. For that, I got $1,500. You know, today I was.
Did you get a $200? It was $1,300. They gave you $200 for saving people's lives.
Yeah.
So give it slipping an extra couple of.
So I got $1,500, and I used that money to pay for flying lessons to get over the fear of flying.
Because it was so upsetting to you. Boy, that's very. Did you just do that immediately?
No. It took a while. But I figured this is the best way to get over it, so I took flying lessons.
So you used the money from your plane crash settlement. Yeah. That's a good idea. I'm going to learn to fly in order to face that fear. That's really that's very very pragmatic, I guess.
Maybe. It might have just been stupid. But
no more crashes since then.
Oh, well.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. I've had... one mid-air collision. We both got done okay in a practice run for something else. And a guy who was my wingman flew into me and took 2 feet off his wingtip and folded my strut. And he's an old pilot. I mean, he knew better, but just it was one of those mistakes. What else has happened?
You were flying in formation, and he ended up hitting you.
Right. And small stuff. A lot of small stuff.
But you've enjoyed it very much, it
Absolutely,
seems.
Absolutely, yes.
You took me flying in your plane.
I did.
In a historic flight where we took off from Santa Monica. It was a glorious day.
Yeah.
I was having in a very small plane. What kind of plane was that?
I don't know. I was so drunk that day.
Really? Well, we were it was two people. We were just front to back. Right. I was almost straddling you. The side of the plane was entirely open. And we had our headsets and everything in order to communicate. So it was very beautiful, very exciting. We flew up the coast, we dipped down, and as surfer, I mean, I still remember it. As surfers, we're surfing on a wave. As the wave curled over on the Pacific Ocean, we're flying down, and of course, not, you know, not buzzing them, but flying down over a wave as it crashes into Malibu. Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. And then the clouds came in very quickly. The clouds came in very quickly, and we got sort of socked in. Mm-hmm. So you went up. Correct me if I'm wrong with this, but you went up higher,
yeah,
in order, and you headed west, I believe. It, your thing was, I'm looking for a hole in these clouds so I can dive through the hole in order to get under this cloud cover. Does that sound reasonable? Well, because I know we did some kind of maneuver where I was having a wonderful day, glorious, and then you did something... You did a maneuver that was quite memorable, and then you were talking to me on the radio, and I was not answering anymore. You're like, Tom, are you okay? I'm heading back to Santa. Are you there? Are you okay? I feel your legs. All right, Tom. And I just, not good, not good. And then, and then I ended up, hurling. I made it my head outside, but I decorated the rear section of your plane and the rear tail.
Did you really?
I did.
You know, I honestly don't remember that. I honestly don't.
You don't?
No.
I was, you were saying, I mean, we were having a wonderful time. And you were saying, well, we'll head north, we'll stop, we'll land somewhere and have lunch and everything. Yeah. And then these series of sort of turns that were relatively quick. And I was just a goner. And then I was trying to get back, you're trying to breathe air and I can get through this, until finally you said, are we going to have lunch? Me want to be on ground. I don't mean want to go out of this. So then I decorated the back of your plane.
Oh, okay.
On the outside.
Good.
We landed in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
We festively hosed down your plane.
Good.
And then and that was it.
So see, no harm done. no harm done.
But when you were first taking your flying lessons and you're overcoming your fear of flying, mm-hmm. when did it become fun?
The first time.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely the first time.
The first time you were kind of over it and you just sort of understood the science of it? Or
no, I still don't understand the science of it. It's just magic.
It's the Bernoulli principle, isn't it, with the wing and how the pressure.
Oh, I love to hear these explanations because they make no sense whatsoever to either of us.
I know. I'm just making it up.
Well, it's good. I'm going with that one.
I think that is the physics thing, isn't it? I think the wing...
I once had another pilot talk to me about the suction. And you know this pilot. I won't name him. But he was a crew member and was saying that the wing had suction. I looked at him like, huh? And, of course, he knew he'd been busted.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, Bernoulli is one of the people who gave us the principles that are applied to flight.
Lift or whatever on a wing, yeah. So I wasn't entirely wrong, Ralph.
No, never.
So you've only flown the small planes that you have.
Right.
I don't know if you collected them or you've had a number of planes over the years, haven't you?
Yeah.
What planes do you like to?
Well, I'm a big fan of tail draggers, and it's just a small plane like the one I think you and I were in my Super Cub, and then later I bought an old military plane, I think called the Bird Dog, and then while I had that plane, I decided that I want to have the world's best Bird Dog, so I bought another one. We flew it for an hour for a photo mission, took it down and took it apart to rebuild it as being the best one on the planet. I figured we had 6 months, we could do it. But 3 years later, after writing a lot of checks, I had the best Bird Dog in the world for about 20 minutes. Because some guy's always behind you with more money and going to build a better one. And that's the plane that I have right now.
And it's called a Bird Dog.
Yeah, it was used... in Korea and Vietnam. And mine flew in the French Army in Algeria.
Really? Mm-hmm. And it was mostly for, what, reconnaissance and those kind of things?
Yeah.
A guy with a Leica rangefinder like the ones you have was up there taking photographs.
Oh, yeah.
And now is that the plane that's in the museum now?
Yes.
That you just a week ago You had quite an adventure taking your plane from Santa Monica Airport.
Well, the adventure was getting the was pushing it around because we just pushed it across the street into the museum. But
so now it's a part of a display.
Temporarily, yes.
Oh.
It's just there for a short time.
From the collection of Ralph Nelson.
Yeah.
What are the other planes that
they got a Beech Stagger Wing, which is quite beautiful. A friend of mine owns it. They've got a few planes in the permanent collection. They've just reopened after about a 10-year shutdown, and so they're starting all over new in a brand new building. It's a great place.
So, and you still fly a lot? Do you still enjoy it?
Yeah,
that's great. But not with anyone throwing up on your plane, though.
It's not. I promise you, you are not the only one.
Oh, really?
Oh, really? I promise you, it's not uncommon.
I was one of the guys who I didn't throw up when I landed on the deck of an aircraft carrier, flying in a COD. Yeah, I landed on the deck and did an arrested landing and everything, and a couple guys threw up. I was just incredibly sick, but I held it in.
What'd you go in the carrier for?
I did a performance. It was coming back from the Persian Gulf. And they said, hey, they've been out of the Persian Gulf for so long. So, they were coming back home and then they would be turned around. Something would heat. Oh, well, turn around, guys. 3 more months. So they were coming in from Hawaii. They said, can we fly a show out there? So we landed on the deck, got out, did a show on the deck. And then the next day flew out as it was coming close to San Diego.
Yeah.
It was amazing. We had F-18 flyovers and everything because it was getting close enough to the mainland that the other planes could go and buzz it and welcome it back. And we had five F-18s, right across the deck, like a Top Gun thing. It was an amazing experience. But most memorable was my not getting that sick on it. So I'm going to let you go, Ralph, because you're very busy. You've been very kind to share your time with me and everybody, because I think it's a fascinating life. I didn't even know you had a younger brother. What's your younger brother's name?
I do.
Yeah.
I have two of them, actually.
Two younger brothers.
I think so.
Now, they weren't with Celeste Holm, but she raised them because she liked them better than you?
No, my father was married 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so Celeste was the first, and my mother, and then a third wife. My mother was married several times, and so there are children from each of those marriages.
Ah.
So my family tree is not as simple as...
Yeah. Was mom an actress?
No. Mom was a farm girl.
Oh, okay. Huh? Would you, Ralph, I know, would you tell that story about when you were working on the set as a still photographer and your dad, the great, august movie director Ralph Nelson, came back to visit you on the set?
Oh,
do you know the one I'm talking about? Because I've quoted it. I've quoted it verbatim because it's an interesting window into working in the movies, into the studios and that kind of thing. So Dad had been away from movies for quite a long time.
Yeah, he had retired, and I was working on Back to the Future, and we were in the big stage there at Universal. And he came by to visit me, and he had done the same. He worked on the same stage with Cary Grant on Father Goose, and he looked around for a while and said, "You know what? I don't miss this one damn bit. And now that I've retired, I really understand even better now that what he meant, because I think you and I know, you know, that as great as it is, that there are people who are doing other great things that." It's not the only, it's not the most important thing in the world, and there are more important issues out there. It's great fun, but it's not the most important thing.
So ultimately, you think it was? I mean, it was so much a part of your dad's life.
Yeah.
But ultimately, looking back on it as an older man,
he
felt, well, when all is said and done, it's a trifle. It's signifying not much of anything. Or was he not missing it at all because of that feeling of being a very expendable,
I can't answer that. I don't know what, but I know that he didn't miss it. And now that I've gone, I don't miss it as much either.
Yeah. And what? And so you've gone off to aviation and to many, many interests in not being on the movie sets. And what did Dad do? He went off and
died.
Dad went off and died. That's the end of a very sad song about Dad. But no, did he die as a? He didn't die while he was working on the movies.
No. This was
he retired, went to New York, and was just a bon vivant.
No. He lived here.
Oh, he lived out here.
Yeah. He lived in California. Moved from New York in the early 60s.
So we touched on it before, but in the end of our conversation now, I try to ask everyone, because I'm talking to people of so many different artistic disciplines and so many different directions that their artistic life has taken, pardon me. But when the person comes to you, the now great, august still photographer of Hollywood history, what do you suggest? What direction do you point them to?
Wow.
And maybe not, it's not simply taking pictures for the movies. Maybe it's just as a visual artist, just as a young photographer.
Well, my first question is always, why do you want to do it? Because if they think that they're going to be spending time on the red carpet and having a great time in Hollywood, then they are living under misconception about what it is. Because it's a lot of it's a lot of work, long hours and difficult days and extreme circumstances quite often, and it's very taxing on the body, and it's not a generally a fun occupation. It's one that requires a lot of patience, a lot of time. A lot of work. Good times can be had, but if someone wants to be around movie stars, then they're going to it for the wrong reason. So it's always my first question: what do you want to do? And as importantly, at the end of your life, when it's all done and said, what do you want to have accomplished? And you think that you'll get that in movies. And I had a fellow recently on Facebook who publicly acknowledged, he said, some time ago I asked Ralph Nelson about advice, and he said, think bigger. That's part of a much larger conversation, and he decided not to become a still photographer. And he's very grateful. He became a cinema photographer instead. And he's very grateful because it is as great as it can be, it's also very limiting in some ways. And so at the end of your life and you look back at what you could have done versus what you've done, there's a disparity there, or can be a disparity if you're not careful. That's why it's important to make those big decisions early on in your life, what you're going to do in the fullness of life. How are you going to, what will you do with it, given that the opportunity and whatever talent you may have, would your time be better spent doing something else? Would you be happier with the results later? If you do it and make less money, if you do it and don't ever meet anyone famous, if you do it and no one ever really knows what you've done, but you feel that you've done something worthwhile, then will it be more important to you in the end?
That's fascinating. And I think bigger is a pretty good one for everybody.
Yeah.
Especially everyone, approaching the arts.
Yeah.
Because I think you're right. A lot of people do think it would be neat to be standing there taking pictures of George Clooney. And from you, you would say, well, why not think bigger than that?
No.
Hmm.
And the pictures I've taken that give me the most satisfaction very seldom have anything to do with actors or acting. And that's not to diminish the importance of that, but the ones that I care most about are those, in some cases, that I've done for friends, and they just hang on their wall because that they will love it, their children will love it, their grandchildren, and that these are the kind of things that, as an example, when there's a catastrophe and people are grabbing the things that are most important to them, they'll grab the pictures first.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there are pictures I've taken that no one will ever know about except for a small circle of friends. And they are precious to them. And for that reason, it's important to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure with literally millions of frames shot by you.
Yeah.
Do you have one that comes back to you? I'm sure there's more than a handful of great shots, but is there one that's particularly satisfying?
There are a few that I can show you, but they are, you would look at them and think, why? It's nothing, it's not like it's a great photograph, it's just something that it pleases me.
But that's what it's all about, though, isn't it? No, I mean, ultimately, of being an artist is you being pleased. Hey, we try to make money at it. Mm-hmm. We try to monetize our skill set, and we get out there. But the little things that we take the most pride in or that are closest to our heart, it almost doesn't matter if anybody else likes it.
And I don't care. Right. Exactly.
I don't care. It's just I like it. Yeah. That's what I came to do. Mm-hmm. A lot of other stuff is great, and it put food on the table.
Yeah.
But that's a little piece that I'm particularly proud of. That's great.
Yeah.
Now, people, you have a website?
Yes.
Nelson Stills?
No.
Is that? No? Not anymore. Sorry.
You didn't look at him, did you?
I did not. I told you. I try to come clean. I try to come, you had Nelson a number of years ago, you had Nelson Stills.
No. It was RalphNelson.com. Very simple.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
No, I'm not.
No, I'm not sorry that you have a website. RalphNelson.com, where there are examples of your work, and you have your iPhone book?
Not yet.
Not yet, but you're putting it. Are you putting it together for people to buy?
Yeah.
And it'll be on RalphNelson.com?
Well, hopefully it goes to a bigger audience than just that, but yes, it'll be out there eventually.
Well, good. Thanks so much, Ralph. I really appreciate talking to you.
Did you really throw up in the airplane?
I did. Not in. Again, I stress, on. I was able to take off my headset, open the window, don't be bashful, don't be shy, just lean out the window and let it fly. And that I did.
I wish I could remember it because I'd like to remember you that way always.
Oh, man. That is a specific shade of green that I don't think anyone has ever seen before or since. Thanks for everything, pal.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for dropping by, everybody. I appreciate your ears. And the next time you see photographs of your favorite movie stars, just remember how much work and how many people go into bringing those images to you. People just like Ralph. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to Chris and Katie over at Nerdist. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to the Cruising Guitars and Dean Markley Strings for always helping me out with my performances on the road. Come by and see a show sometime. Make sure you say hi and mention the podcast. But most of all, as I always do, I thank you for tuning in because I'm amazed at the reaction, and I appreciate it very much. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.